Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Welcome to another episode of Unstoppable Mindset. And today we have a person who I regard as a very special guest. I'm a little bit prejudiced, though. You know my story if you've listened to these podcasts regularly. 20 years ago, I worked in the World Trade Center and escaped with my guide dog, Roselle. And in, I think, June, if I recall right, maybe it was earlier than that, maybe it was like April or May of 2010, I got a phone call on a Sunday afternoon from a woman who said that she was writing a book called Dog Tales. And she said she wanted to include Roselle's story. I noticed it wasn't my story. It was Roselle's story in her book and asked if I would tell her our story. And I did. There was this pause afterward. And then she said, why aren't you writing your own book? And she offered to help. And the result of that was that Susie Flory introduced me to her agent. We created a proposal and Thunderdog was published in August, officially released in August of 2011. And I thought it would be kind of fun to have Susie on to tell her story and to compare notes and talk about whatever comes along. So Susie, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Thank you, Mike. I'm so glad to be here with you.
I've been looking forward to this for a while, and I think that we'll have a lot of fun, and we'll see who all we can pick on. What can I say? But here we are. So tell me, what got you into writing in the first place? What made you start to go down that path?
It was kind of a childhood dream. It's kind of one of those, you know, I want to be a lion tamer, I want to be an astronaut kind of dreams for me, because I didn't know any writers and I had no idea how to go about it, but I just always loved reading. And I know you love reading too. We're very alike in that way. And so I just grew up in a world of books and ideas and stories. And just always thought, wow, if I could do that. But I didn't think it was a real kind of dream. And then I got to work at a newspaper and I sort of started to see that there might be a way in. And it wasn't until my late 30s that I went to a writer's conference. And I remember seeing a book editor walk by for a publishing house, and he was wearing kind of grubby tennis shoes and jeans and a t-shirt. And I thought, he's just a normal guy. He's just a regular person. Because I think I thought, you know, people who did writing and publishing were highly evolved beings that I could not be a part of. And so that was just kind of my way in, was just seeing, hey, maybe I can do this.
And there you are.
And here we are.
So you
an overnight success after 20 years.
So you were working at a newspaper. And what were you a reporter?
I was a features writer.
Okay.
I'm not really a hard news person, although I love to read the news, but I love the stories behind the news and particularly people stories. So even though I was writing that book, Dog Tales, you know, I was very interested in the people's tales as well. And so I love meeting interesting, unique people who have a story to tell, which is almost everyone in the world if you sit down and talk to them.
Well, how did you, how did you get into doing a book?
So that's another big jump. So when you're in a newspaper, you know, you get an assignment or you get a lead or you have an idea yourself and you go out and write a little story on it. You can do it in a few days typically. So I kind of knew how to do that, but it wasn't enough for me. I, you know, wrote some shorter stories, got some things published, and then just found myself wanting to go deeper and do research and meet people and just get bigger stories down on paper. So that was kind of a craving for me. And I think it's because I gravitated towards books because I loved books so much. And so one of my very early books was a memoir that I wrote for myself. It's called a stunt memoir. And it's kind of where you set yourself some assignments and then you live them out and write about them. So I decided to investigate the women who I thought had changed the world. People like Harriet Tubman, Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, Rosie the Riveter, and do something that those women had done. And I just created like this little set of assignments for myself. And I was terrified because writing a book is really hard, as you know, or maybe it was easy for you. I don't know, Mike, maybe it was easy for you. But writing a book is hard for me, but I enjoyed it so much, the challenge, and it pushed me and challenged me. So that's kind of how I shifted from writing articles, which felt doable, to books, which seemed extremely hard and scary.
What was your first book published?
So my first book was about the Da Vinci Code. Do you remember that story?
Yes.
It was published in the early 2000s, and it really took the writing and publishing world by storm unexpectedly. And there was a lot to talk about. The book was about Jesus, and maybe he was married, and maybe there was this whole mystery that we didn't know. And the book was fiction. It was all made up. But it really touched on some things I think people were curious about. So my first book was called Fear Not, Da Vinci. And it kind of centered on these big questions that people had.
How did you get it published since you had not published a book before?
Good question, because I didn't have an agent at that point. And basically what you do is you start submitting. So without an agent, you create what's called a query letter. And it's basically a pitch, a short pitch. And back in the day, you could either mail them. So you would write a letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope inside, hoping that you would get a response. Or it was really kind of early days of email correspondence as well. So you could do either, and you would contact, you would basically be cold calling editors and trying to get them excited about you and your writing and whatever your idea was. So that's what I did. And I got 13 rejections on that first book. And number 14, I found an editor who was interested, who I had met at a writer's conference. So I think when they meet brand new writers at a writer's conference, industry people, they can see that you're not a crazy person and they might want to work with you. So it's a good groundwork to lay. So going to a conference, meeting an editor, and then writing these query letters is how I got that book deal.
How's that evolved till today? Is the process different now, do you think?
It's very similar if you don't have an agent. You still have to jump through these hoops. And that's how they weed a lot of people out who, you know, are not informed, who want an easy way in. The pitching process is similar, but right now I have an agent, so that literary agent helps with that process, but I still have to create the pitch, still create a book proposal, still, you know, develop the whole thing without actually writing it yet. And then, you know, the publisher needs to see what this book is going to be. They need a very good idea of it before they invest in it. So it's a lot of work. It's kind of that pre-production part.
Yeah, which is true, whether it's in writing or in selling or anything that you do or that anyone does, there's always going to be a process. And it's, in a sense, it's good it hasn't changed because, as you said, so many people want an easy way in. And the fact is there isn't an easy way in.
Right. You got to do your homework and prepare ahead of time. And then you may or may not be lucky.
Yeah.
But you can't be lucky if you don't prepare. And yeah. I know that you are so good at that, Mike. You're really great. You're an inspiration to me how you do the homework and prepare for everything that you do.
Well, thank you. You mentioned about easy or hard at writing. What I did when we did Thunder Dog, I had written lots of notes. I had created a lot of thought on paper and wrote a lot of the history, but that wasn't a book yet. And then when you said, well, why aren't you writing your own book? And we started working toward that and created a proposal that that was sellable. And of course, you having an agent, that was valuable too. But the point is that then when we started working on the book, all those notes came together. And what you did was you used your newspaper skills, if you will, to coalesce that. And then we worked together on creating it. I'll never forget when we were working with the folks at Thomas Nelson, and they came back and they said, the problem with your book right now is that you don't have good transitions between being in the World Trade Center and going back to previous places in your life. And it hit me, oh, I know how to do that. And I had never really thought about it before, but over a weekend created those transitions, and they love that. And of course, Kirkus liked that when they did their review of the book. But we worked well as a team, and I think there's value in that too, because we had a story to tell, and you adopted our story, and we made it a collective story, which I think helped.
Yeah, because you can have a wonderful story, and a lot of people do, but you have to make it entertaining and enjoyable and readable and engaging and almost like addictive. You know, I kind of think of it like the first date. You have a cover and a title and maybe a first page to connect with the reader. And then after that, it better work because they're not going to stick around for long if it's not exciting to read.
Right. I remember reading the first Harry Potter book, and it took a while to catch on. But we read it after lots of others had gone. I think actually it was the third book had already come out by the time we discovered it. And Karen and I stuck with it. We read the audio version with Jim Dale. And for a while we kept saying, well, what is it that excites people about this? Because it just started out so slowly. But because there was such a big furor over it, we stuck with it. And it got better as it went along, but it didn't start out grabbing us with that first page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt like that too. But I think maybe children, you know, I mean, it was kind of geared towards what, sixth, seventh, eighth graders, kind of that was maybe the primary audience at first.
Yeah, like and us.
Yeah. And I feel like they might stick with something longer than a grown-up reader would. And so in that case, I think we kind of followed what the kids were enjoying and then kind of figured out, oh, this is good storytelling. It did kind of build, you know, it had to build. I agree with you on that.
And we have now read them all three times going through, you know, they're great books to read. What about self-publishing? How does that fit into the scheme of just the world of writing a book and getting a book out, but also can that help in terms of either that book or later books getting noticed by editors?
Yeah, so self-publishing, there are so many options these days. It's kind of the Wild West of publishing, and you know, you have so many ways that you can be published. It's actually kind of confusing and overwhelming for people, where it used to be more kind of straightforward. I think with self-publishing, if you have some sort of platform, so if you are out there speaking, teaching, You have some sort of, you know, media channel, a name for yourself. I think it's a really, really great option. If you don't have that, you need to be prepared to do some advertising. And people have made a way for themselves self-publishing that way as well. But it also works for someone who wants to publish something for friends and family. So I think a lot of this depends on your expectations. And in a world where physical bookstores, many of them have gone away and much book shopping has gone online, it really is a viable option, but you really need to educate yourself and, you know, be involved at every step of the process. Where when you're with a traditional legacy publisher, there are times you can kind of just let them take the lead on certain things.
Do you think that the traditional publishing world is going to go away with everything being online and so on?
That is such a great debate, and it's been raging for years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really changes, like, you know, depending on what's going on in the world and what's going on in the culture, the type of books that sell or don't sell change. But right now, the publishing industry is doing just fine. And so I think there's always the danger, but there's something about physical books that people love and have loved for thousands of years. So I don't see it completely going away. I do see it completely, you know, continuing to change and evolve.
I hope that libraries and bookstores and the traditional publishing world doesn't go away. I think you're right. And I don't know how to really describe what it is. Just sit down with a book. You know, for me, it's in Braille, of course, but still reading a book in Braille is not the same as listening to a recorded book. Just like reading books with an electronic device just apparently isn't the same as sitting there and being able to turn the printed page. Time after time, I hear people say that there's just nothing like reading that printed book.
And, you know, people worry about television and the streaming services, you know, Netflix and all those things that offer so many options for entertainment. But there are still, I think, a very loyal and solid segment of the population that are word people. We love words. And, you know, words in a book are they speak to us deeply. And so I think we're safe for now, Mike.
Yeah. Well, and if you could get some of those people who watch TV to sit down and read an engaging book, and if they truly get engaged, I wonder if that would change some of their views. Because what a book brings that television doesn't is the whole issue of imagination. I have listened to radio shows that really evoke imagination, and I've even watched a few television shows that compel you to imagine. They don't spell everything out, and I find those to be most engaging of all.
I love that. Yeah, I'm actually in school right now, working on a master's, and my thesis that I'm working on touches on this idea that the reader collaborates and participates in the story. And so a book is going to be different. Every time a person picks up a book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, it's going to be a little different. It's going to hit that person differently because they're participating in that experience. It's like, as a writer, you're talking inside of their head and having a conversation with them. But you're not just dictating what they're going to think and feel and imagine. So yeah, I love that. It's a process of engaging the imagination.
It's interesting to think about textbooks. I am still of the opinion, having read many textbooks in my life, especially physics textbooks and so on, I think authors of textbooks are really missing it by just making the textbooks about fact and theory and teaching what they teach and never putting stories in. I think they could do so much more if they both personalized it and put some stories behind the teaching in the books that would make them more compelling for people to want to read.
I agree. And when I used to read, I don't read magazines too often these days, but back in the day, I used to read a lot of women's magazines and fashion and culture and all the stuff. And I would always read the story, the story part of the article, and just skip over the teaching and bullet points and facts part. So I totally agree with you.
Well, even magazines like Playboy, you know, I don't know how many people know, but one of the best science fiction stories of all, The Fly, was originally published in Playboy. And Playboy had stories, no matter what else it was doing, and all the other different things that went into it, the creators of that magazine recognized the value of good stories and good writing too. One of my favorite stories about September 11th is that a week or so later, after the events of September 11th, and we got very visible in the media, I got a call from America Media. And of course, they're the people who publish the National Enquirer and other magazines and papers, which tend to be weak on accurate content and more on sensationalism. And this person wanted to do an interview, and they said it was going to be serious. And we talked on the phone, and they wanted to send someone out to take pictures. And I said, okay. And I went off and I told my wife, Karen, that this was happening. And of course, she immediately hit the roof. They're going to sensationalize it. How could you even agree to that? You know who they are. They're crazy. And in fact, the guy called the day before he was going to come out to take the picture. And he said, I want to make sure that I'm calling the right person. This is Michael Hinkson, who was in the elevator that fell from the 100th floor to the bottom and survived. And he's the guy, right? And Karen immediately said, nobody's coming out to take pictures. Well, what we found out later was that, in fact, there had been that rumor and they were investigating it, but American Media still published our story as part of a journal that they put out around the World Trade Center. And it was actually one of the most journalistically best pieces, not just my story, but the whole magazine was one of the best pieces that I had ever encountered. And Karen acknowledged it as well. They were very accurate. They were very thorough and told a great story. So, you know, they can do it. Sort of like the Harlem Globetrotters, right? They have to be great basketball players to do what they do.
Yeah, I know that sometimes they hire really good writers for their special editions too, and they charge more for them because it's, you know, they're putting out a book basically.
Right. And they did a really great job with this one. And so, you know, people can do it. What do publishers look for when someone is sending them a proposal and so on? What are they looking for?
They look for three things, Mike. They look for a great idea. They look for great writing, superior writing with a distinct voice to it. And then they look for platform, that you have some kind of connection with your readers and that there are people out there who will buy what you have to say. Because a lot of people have great ideas or they can write, but, you know, to get someone to actually purchase a book, to invest in it, there has to be that connection in some way, some fashion or another. So those are the three things they look for. They will sometimes accept two out of three. So if you have an incredible story or book idea, an incredible writing gift that you have refined with a distinct voice, sometimes you can squeak by without a platform or, you know, one of the other things. So that's kind of the scoop.
Well, I noticed that when we did Thunder Dog, the world had already changed to the point where they weren't doing as many book tours and the publishers weren't doing as much marketing. They were also requiring that we, as the people who were writing the book and proposing, had to demonstrate that what we were going to bring to marketing the book.
That's right. Yeah, we had a lot of fun coming up with ideas and, you know, having meetings and things like that.
Well, and we did. And, you know, I think it actually did help a lot in not only getting visibility for the book, because we had of course, you and I, the biggest stake of all. We were the authors, the creators of the book, but that also it gave us an insight into the world and the things that the publishers do and wanted to do. And they did their part as well. But today it is true that an author has to be ready to be able to help sell the book.
Absolutely. You kind of become almost like your own little multimedia corporation, but you know, on a very small scale. But you have to get the word out. And that doesn't mean just going on Facebook and saying, mm-hmm. buy my book. You have to look at where people are hanging out and what they like to read and do. And you need to be out there being excited about your book, which is easy to do if you have written something that, you know, is very meaningful, that you care about deeply. I always had a great time talking about Thunder Dogs. I was out there talking about it. You were talking about it 10 times more and more effectively, but we did. We just had a good time sharing the story, sharing the things that you had learned and wanted to share in the book.
And still do, by the way.
That's right. And it's a story that never gets old, Mike.
No, it doesn't get old. It's going to be there. It's fun to go out on the road still and do speeches and travel and tell my story and talk about teamwork and trust and all sorts of things. And one of the things that I love to do somewhere in the course of every talk that I give is to encourage people to buy the book. And then I have, well, nowadays Alamo sit up and I say, look, Alamo just told me that we're running low on kibbles. And so being a poor starving author, we need you guys to buy books because Alamo says he's got to be able to eat tomorrow.
Which is the truth.
Which right? is the as truth, you, by the way.
As we're you not... know, right? Writers work hard for their kibble.
That's right. And their dogs expect a piece of the action.
That's right. Yeah, that was such a fun summer, Mike, hanging out at your house with Roselle and Africa and Fantasia. You had three big, beautiful labs that would be kind of wrestling at our feet as we talked. Yeah. It was a wonderful summer.
Yeah, it was. And we lost, well, Africa retired in 2018, and then Fantasia passed away the next year. So we are now a one dog family, but we also have a cat. So we do keep busy with all of those. So tell me, what is the difference between a memoir and a biography or an autobiography?
Yeah, I think one thing to talk about it with that question first is to say that there are kind of two categories of memoir. There are memoirs by big celebrities. So this might be a person like Michelle Obama or Bill Gates or something like that. They can write whatever they want to write. So they may call it a memoir. More often it's an autobiography and they tell you the whole story of their life and it's like 500 pages, you know, it's like this big, huge brick of a book.
Yeah.
But they're in a different category. They're just a household name. For most of us, myself included, people don't know us as well. And so we try to write an exciting story. So a memoir is making a story of your life. It's a true story. But you're doing some storytelling and you have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You have an exciting moment that you're building to. And a lot of times it focuses on a season of your life. So Thunder Dog focused on your 9/11 story and then, you know, brought in things from your life as part of the book. And so a memoir is more focused than an autobiography. It's not a history. It's not a comprehensive history of your life.
Yeah, and I've read some pretty boring autobiographies. And there again, it goes back to what I said earlier. My theory is that putting some stories in help. We're preparing, as you know, and have now submitted a proposal for a book. Originally, we were talking about calling it Blinded by Fear, but Carrie and I are calling it now A Guide Dog's Guide to Being Brave. And it's about fear and it's about overcoming fear. And it's about how when you're confronted with an unexpected life change, you are often so fearful that you become blinded to making good choices. You don't learn how to use that fear in a positive and strong way. But one of the things that I believe is important in writing that book is to include stories to illustrate points along the way, because I think that makes any book more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that stories stick with me. And so, you know, if I go to church and the preacher's preaching this amazing 10-point sermon, I'm not going to remember the points unless there's stories involved. So I'll walk out and remember the stories, but not remember the points.
Well, and the stories may be able to take you back to the points, but but still, the stories are what sticks with you because they're personal. You can you get drawn into the stories because you can make them personal and kind of make them your own, and you can feel what's going on in the story.
Yeah, I love that. And that was so important with your story, because most people are never going to have the set of experiences that you had on 9/11. They just aren't, you know, that was a unique event. But by telling your stories and opening up your life and your world, you know, your hopes, dreams, fears, all of that, people can relate to that. And that's what made your story so, I think, engaging, makes it so engaging and relatable.
So going back to memoirs, you created a community called Educational Memoir, right?
It's called Everything Memoir.
Everything Memoir. And is that to teach people to write memoirs or?
Yeah, and it was never aimed at professional writers, although some writers are part of the community, but at any ordinary person who wants to write their story. And so you probably have people ask you for advice with writing and publishing, and I've had that a lot. And at some point, you can't help everyone. You can't give every individual person, you can't go to coffee with them and tell them what to do and help them. And so I created this educational community, and it's on Facebook. We have a private group. And then I'm also doing a one-year coaching group where people can write their memoir in a year with some coaching and help and feedback. And so, so many people want to write their stories and they just don't know how to do it. Or they write something that's difficult to read, that's not engaging. So my mission and goal is to help people write a good, readable, interesting memoir.
Well, and you said at the beginning that most everyone has a story to tell. And I think that's absolutely true. You know, I'm working, as you know, with Accessibe. So we deal with making websites more accessible. And the whole story is about the fact that only 2% of websites today are usable, and most are not. They're not fully inclusive. And I'm looking forward to the time when someone will really write the story. It's still new because there's so much of it that's being written in history, if you will. But I'm looking forward to the time that we can write the story of Accessibe and the story of how the internet becomes more inclusive. And already there are just so many incredible tales to tell about website access, things that people have done, things that people have learned along the way that have helped them create more inclusive environments in their own world, and how making a website inclusive has made other parts of a company inclusive, and so on. And it'll be a fun story to tell at some point. It's kind of one of those things that's evolving today.
It'll be nice when it's history, right? Rather than a current problem.
Yeah. Well, and a current event, but it will happen. And that's what's going to be a lot of fun. But people do have stories, and it would be nice if more people would learn how to articulate and tell their stories. I think that too many people are losing the whole idea and the whole ability of using words to create images that people can read and see. So they're losing this ability to write, which is extremely unfortunate.
Yeah, they may feel like I did once upon a time, that there are these amazing books and stories out there, but that they can't do that themselves. And I feel like with some help and some practical, you know, solutions and templates, that people can.
What about fiction as opposed to nonfiction? in terms of writing skills and so on, because people, like we mentioned Harry Potter, what a creative thing, which is just totally out of imagination.
Yeah, one big way to learn if better, if you should aim at fiction or nonfiction, if you're, you know, want to write a book, is what do you enjoy reading? And for me, I enjoy reading nonfiction. I love true stories, big, true kind of adventure, exciting stories. And so that's what I gravitate to when I go into a bookstore or a library. That's where I'm heading. And I read fiction sometimes, but not heavily. And so that's one good way to figure out what you should be writing. And fiction people are interesting novelists. They have stories inside of their heads. And so they walk around the story and these characters and these, you know, events, and eventually they have to write it down. And so it's like they're always incubating these stories.
Yeah. And you and I both have our favorite authors. I'm still working on convincing you that Mark Twain is the best, but, you know, we'll get there.
I'm not saying I don't like Mark Twain.
Who's your favorite author?
Oh, goodness. That's such a great question.
Oh, fiction. We'll do fiction.
Fiction. Right now, I'm enjoying reading Barbara Kingsolver. So she wrote, she's written several things, but she's a great storyteller. And Ann Patchett. I love Ann Patchett, who's a Southern novelist who kind of writes these big epic novels about families that are all interconnected and have secrets and things like that. So those are probably my two favorites.
We do a lot of fiction reading at home here because we play audiobooks and can listen to them while doing other things. That's really hard to do with a nonfiction book. You do have to concentrate differently and more on nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Although memoir can read, it depends on the memoir. The famous ones, you know, the famous celebrity memoirs, no. But a really well-written memoir can almost be like a novel. It's very similar to how a novel, you know, unfolds. And so those can be super engaging, but they have to be well-written.
It's all about the story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and engaging the reader, kind of.
And engaging the reader, and that's again easier to do. Both Karen and I find sometimes that we're reading, and suddenly we go, "How did they get there?" Because our mind went off in a different direction. You know, the book just took us somewhere, and we just leaped off into a theme, and then we come back and they're in a different place now.
Yeah, there has to be a logic, you know, there has to be planning that's happened behind the scenes that maybe you aren't aware of as a reader, but it does all have to fit together, kind of like the structure of a house, the framing of the house.
Well, in the case of audiobooks also, the other part of it is that the reader of the book, the person reading the book and recording it, has something to do with it. I've been spoiled by some really good readers of talking books over the years for blind people and find that there are some people who professionally are recording books for everyone today who are good. But I also find that sometimes there aren't good readers or that for some reason we don't react well to them. And that diminishes the book a great deal, unfortunately. And they may very well be good books, but still.
Some audio, do you call them a performer or a narrator? What's an audio book?
I call them a reader, but, you know, people call them performers. Okay. Some people call them narrators.
And some are like actors. Yeah, they are. Some are like, they just make it come alive, and some are very dead. So I totally get that.
Some are actors. I remember years ago as a child reading Kidnapped by Robert Louis Stevenson, and Roddy McDowall read it, the actor. And there have been others. My favorite science fiction book of all times, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein, was read by Robert Donnelly, who was primarily a radio actor, but was perfect for this book. And I've read other books by actors who've just been very good. And they put voices in the books, and they use different voices for different characters, and they pull it off really well.
Yeah, I have a book coming out in February that's set in Ireland, and I'm hoping for the audiobook that they have somebody who can, you know, an Irish person or somebody who can have a really good Irish accent. I just listened to, have you ever listened to Angela's Ashes on audiobook?
A while ago, yes.
Yeah, Frank McCourt. He read it himself. Right. Yeah, and his voice, he was so alive. He did voices. And he would also sing Irish songs as part of the, and you would totally miss that if you were reading it on paper.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, some people can bring a book to life, and sometimes the author is the best one to do that. Tell us about the book in February.
Yeah, this is a book I've been working on for a couple of years. It's called Sanctuary, and it's about a real life donkey whisperer in Ireland. A man named Patrick Barrett, and he grew up, his father started Ireland's donkey sanctuary. So they've rescued thousands of donkeys over the years, because the problem is donkeys can live 50 to 60 years. They're sort of like parrots, and people will grow old or their life conditions will change. And this poor donkey is just kind of left to fend for itself. And it happens all the time. They'll find donkeys by the roadside that are starving. And so he grew up in this atmosphere. And as he grew up, he ran into different kinds of troubles and struggles. And it ended up that his father's donkey sanctuary actually rescued him. And so it's small town Ireland, small village Ireland, with the castle, you know, on the main street, and donkeys, and Irish family, and redemption.
It was a great book to read. I remember you asking me to read it and write the foreword and the endorsement for it. And
that's right. Yeah, your foreword is right up front there.
The only thing I never did see in the book was a leprechaun. So I still tease you about that.
We made a rule. No leprechauns in the book or on the cover.
They might get you in trouble. You know, those leprechauns, they know these things.
There are fairies over there. I don't know if there are leprechauns, but there's a strong belief in fairies and banshees as well. So,
Irish
talk about imagination. The Irish have strong literary and beautiful imagination.
You really don't want to run into a banshee, though.
You don't. No, you don't.
Now, I've seen Darby O'Gill. I know about these things.
Apparently, they make a really strange noise at night, and you want to stay inside when you hear that noise.
Yeah, you don't really want to come out where they are. Well, so that book is coming out in February, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it out. And do you have any say, or do you have any ability to provide input into who will read it if it gets onto Audible or in a recorded form?
No, so far I have not had that. And I don't think Patrick wants to read it himself. He's super busy. He has lots of kids and a busy life. So I think they, you know, will choose the best person that they can.
I would hope they would do an interview with him, though. I mean, he is a very interesting person, just having read the book. And I would hope that there'd be an opportunity to hear his voice somehow.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. And he can do voices himself. You know, he can, one of the reasons he's called a donkey whisperer is he can talk to donkeys in their own language, the way that they talk. They have very extensive vocabulary. And he can also imitate people as well. So he's very good at that. He has that ear for that.
That will be exciting to have come out. Now, you also have another book that has been made into a movie, and that's coming out next year, right?
Yes, and you know, I said Sanctuary was coming out in February. I was wrong. It's actually coming out St. Patrick's Day in March.
Good day for it to come out.
But that same week, it's very odd. This was not planned, but a book that I did a few years ago called The Unbreakable Boy. It's a father-son story about a boy with brittle bone disease and autism. That was made into a movie recently. It's being released by Lionsgate Studios, and Zachary Levi and Patricia Heaton are starring, and it comes out the exact same week as Sanctuary. So it's a very strange and unusual week in my world.
Well, double opportunity.
That's right. We're going to try to do, we have plans to do a movie premiere up in the San Francisco Bay Area. We're renting out a small theater, a single screen theater. So I'm hoping that will all come to fruition and we'll have some fun with a little, we're going to have some red carpet and the whole thing.
Oh, cool.
And you know about red carpets. You've been on red carpets.
Yeah. Well, here's a question. How has the pandemic affected reading and books, do you think, and writing for that matter?
I know children's books and YA young adult books have been selling like crazy, you know, with kids at home and homeschooling and things like that. I do know fiction and novels, novels are fiction, but fiction is much stronger right now. People want entertainment and escape.
Escape, yeah.
And so, yeah, they don't necessarily want to read heavy, you know, dark, difficult, you know, material, challenging material. They want to escape. They want to escape to some place like Ireland or, you know, something like that. So fiction's doing well.
Well, it's very understandable. I mean, there's so many heavy things that we're dealing with, the things that have happened over the past 2 years, and we're just slammed with the media or by the media with all of the stuff that you want to escape. We've stayed home and not done any travel. I did my first trip to speak in May of this year, and that was the first one since March of last year. And traveling has been significantly less, but you know, staying at home has been a lot more bearable when we read books together. And so it's also Karen and I are sharing it, but reading, and I admit, as I said before, a fair amount of fiction helps just escape and get away from all this stuff that we're sick and tired of seeing on television and hearing.
Yeah, I agree. I've been reading a lot and watching a lot as well. Watching things like The Great British Baking Show. So yes, escape has been important. And that's the beautiful thing about stories. They do sweep you away.
We watched The Holiday Bake Off this last Sunday. Learned some new recipes. I don't know whether we'll try them, but we're trying to keep the calorie count down too. That's the unfortunate thing about the bake-off.
So true. That's been a hard thing for me during the pandemic is I love chocolate.
Well, yeah.
And so, yeah, I have a little country grocery store that I go to here in Volcano, and they have See's candy right by the cash register. So it's been a big temptation. Have a box of chocolate and a good book and sit there and enjoy it.
Well, I must admit, as I've said many times over the past year, Instacart and Grubhub are our friends, and it's very convenient that we can get some things, like now that Christmas is here, peppermint bark from Costco and other things. So yeah, it's always good to have a little chocolate around. Every time we do have to go deal with Kaiser or a doctor or anything like that, I keep saying, when you're writing prescriptions, please put that 10-pound box of C's in. Nobody's done that yet. It's very disappointing.
Yeah, they should make a deal with C's. I think that could work out.
I think so. I don't quite see the problem.
I don't either.
Well, and another thing, I know that it's very important for authors to have websites and have things up on the internet. That's, of course, a great way not only to advertise, but to establish personal relationships with people. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't explore how we might help authors do a better job of making their websites accessible so that people with various disabilities who might not be able to access part of their sites get the access that everyone else has. Probably a lot of author websites are not overly complex websites. They're not, they will have pictures and so on, but they're not necessarily overly complex. But it would be great to explore ways to work with the author world to help them make their websites more accessible.
Yeah, and kind of the, probably the one of the most influential organizations is the Authors Guild. So I think, you know, if they can jump in and cooperate and partner with you, I think it would be a huge victory.
Well, you and I had talked about that before, and we never did really follow through much, but there's been a lot going on. So I'd love to get any help you can in reaching some of the folks there, but also if any authors are listening, as we've talked about on these podcasts, Accessibee helps makes websites a lot more accessible, and it's not an expensive process. And I mean, it's really not an expensive process. So people ought to go to accessibee.com and check it out. And also they can go to our website audit tool called ACE, which you can get to at accessibee.com, or just go to ace.accessibee.com and plug in your website address and see how accessible it is, and learn about the things that you need to do to make it more accessible and usable. Because the reality is that over 20% of people in the world have a disability. And if you make your website accessible to those people, you can get up to 20% more business. And I mean, who could argue with doing that?
I love that. Yeah. As writers, we want to speak and write and communicate and tell our stories to everyone. And no one should be excluded from that.
It's not that magical or hard to do. And so, you know, I hope that it will happen more and more. And I know authors tend to really, truly be starving and don't have a lot of income, but Accessibee is a way to do it. But we could certainly explore working with the Authors Guild. And you're right, that is something that we should do. So,
and also as published authors who have, if you're a traditionally published author or self-published who go through publishing companies who offer those services, it's something that we can request from our publishers.
Good point, that they also deal with access and make it accessible right from the outset. We had to do some of that, as I recall, with Thomas Nelson. There were some things that weren't accessible, but they fixed it.
That's right.
And it is one of the things that, as we're dealing with A Guide Dog's Guide to Being Brave, however that goes, access has to be a part of it. We've been working toward making Thunder Dog a movie, although that's moving very slowly. The pandemic hasn't helped. But again, as that happens, it will need to have an audio track and be accessible so that it'll have to be described so blind people can have access to it, much less everything else that goes along with it. So it will be fun to see how it goes. But, you know, the reality is access is just something that tends not to be included in the conversation. We need to figure out ways to get it more visible and get more people making sure that they provide inclusion. It's just not that expensive and hard to do.
Yeah, I love that you're advocating in this area, Mike, that you're persistent and consistent with it.
We need to get some of those Irish fairies to help us.
That's right.
They have influence. Either that or their friends, the leprechauns, who stay in hiding, but they have to have influence.
And some of the stubbornness of the donkeys. You know, donkeys are stubborn because they're smart and they are opinionated. And so they come off as stubborn.
Well, I know that if I ever get to Ireland, I do want to go meet Patrick. I look forward to that. Mm. And, you know, the other thing is, if people don't deal with access, we could always point out that we probably can find people who can help us get a deal with a banshee, you know, to get them to make their sites accessible.
That's right. We'll set the banshees on you.
Yeah, we'll set the banshees on you. It works for me. I really want to thank you for being here and being a part of Unstoppable Mindset. We haven't had a chance to chat for a while, and the pandemic has been, for me, it's actually kept me pretty busy just with things going on. And so I can't complain about that. But I think also, again, it comes back to how you approach it. And, you know, so this is just another adventure and a chapter in life too.
That's right. So fun to visit with another storyteller, Mike. And I love that you are telling your story in this new venue now with your podcast.
it's a lot of fun. Well, invite people to come and listen. And of course, we hope that people will give us good 5-star ratings. And if you know of anyone else who ought to be a guest, I'd love to chat with people and bring them on. So we really love to deal with this unstoppable thing. And I just realized there's something else that we should talk about in your life, because you've been confronted by a couple of major life changes, like with the whole breast cancer concept and so on, that have suddenly thrown things in your way, but you motored through them.
That's right. I had breast cancer just before you and I started working together. And so I was still recovering from it, because it takes a while, you know, with surgeries and treatment and medication and all the things. And I decided that I didn't have time to wait anymore, or to be afraid, or, you know, to let things hold me back. And so I'm not saying I became unstoppable, but I did feel like I went into turbo after I recovered from breast cancer. And I literally did think I was going to die. My dad had died in his 40s of cancer. And so I thought that might be my path. And so when I survived, I decided to move forward and, you know, have courage. And I think that's probably what led to me writing you that email that one day.
Well, the issue isn't unstoppable, but an unstoppable mindset. It still is. It's all about how you choose to approach things, whoever you are. And the bottom line is that mostly we have control over a lot of things in our lives, and there are things that we don't have control over. But if you worry about the things you can't control, you'll go off on strange paths. If you focus on what you can and let the rest take care of itself, most always you're better off for it.
That's right. My mindset became, my unstoppable mindset became for me the thought or the idea of, why not? You know, what do I have to lose? Why not try? And so I became more comfortable with the idea of having some failures, which is going to happen whenever you try something new. But, you know, just the idea of, why not? Why not try?
But I also love the idea that the whole point behind a failure is not that it's a failure. It's an opportunity to learn and move forward too.
Mm-hmm. And it's normal.
It's normal.
Some amount of failure is normal in this life. And once you realize that that's just part of it, and maybe you had to get that out of the way before you could move forward.
Right. Which gets back to mindset, which is cool. Well, again, I want to thank you for taking the time to be here. You've got lots going on and books to write. What's the next project?
This one's kind of funny. It's called The Ultimate Bible Nerd, and I bought, it's the foremost Bible dictionary. It's in 6 volumes. So if you kind of picture your whole desk being taken up by these giant books, and I'm going to read through it. It's 7 million words. I'm going to read through 7 million words in a year and write about it. So we will see what comes out of that. I'm not quite sure yet.
Make it a novel.
That's right. It's not going to be 7 million words, I'll tell you that much.
That is a little bit long to deal with. But I bet that whatever comes out is going to be fascinating and worth reading. I'm going to have to go off and look up Fear Not Da Vinci.
It's out of print, but I think there's still a few copies floating around.
Was it ever, I'm assuming it wasn't an audiobook.
I think this was before audiobooks were routine.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it was not.
Have to look anyway. You never know. Well, thanks again for being here. And it was good talking with you. And I want to thank everyone for listening. And again, if you have any questions, you want to reach out. Susie, how can people reach out and find you?
My website is susyflory.com, and my name is spelled SusyFlory. Or you can find me on Facebook at Everything Memoir.
Cool. And as always, if you have questions, comments, thoughts, please feel free to reach out to me, Michael Hingson. Web address to reach out to is michaelhi@accessibe.com, michaelhi@accessibe.com. Please go to michaelhingson.com/podcast to learn more about the podcast if you haven't listened to us before. We hope that you'll give us a 5-star rating in whatever podcast host you are using. If you know anyone who might be a good guest, or if you'd like to talk about coming on the podcast and chatting with us, please reach out. Would love to hear from you. And you can rest assured that I will respond. So thank you very much for listening to Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Thanks for listening. You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled AccessiBE. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.